Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Wesley J. Smith. Wesley is the author of Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Most recently, he's the author of many other books besides. And he's the senior fellow, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. It's an institute, Wesley?
Yes, it's a think tank in Seattle.
A think tank in Seattle. Attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and a consultant to the Center for Bioethics and Culture out in California, which is actually now all over the country. It's got
They seem to have seven or eight different locations. So, yes, they're spreading.
They're spreading, yeah.
You might say metastasizing.
I might indeed say metastasizing. Wesley and I are like our favorite sparring partners, apparently.
Yeah.
So for the guests who find that a little odd, well, just get used to it. We recently published reviews of each other's books in betterhumans.com that you can read there. Wesley's book, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World, was very critical of transhumanist trends and stem cells and other things, and he published a review of my book, Citizen Cyborg. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. But let's start first with stem cells. I'm sure that you saw recently this week that President Bush announced that he had a renewed commitment to restricting the use of embryos in research in the United States, and that he was going to be putting a lot more energy into trying to be a little bit tighter, at least with federal funding around that.
Well, I think what's going on is there's a lot of mix-up in terms of terms. For example, you said I don't like stem cells. I love some stem cells. So, you know, that's a generic term that can include umbilical cord blood stem cells, adult stem cells, and I'm very much in favor of that type of research. I don't think the president's going to further restrict federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. I think what that refers to is continuing attempts at the federal level to restrict somatic cell nuclear transfer in humans, which has been redefined over a series of terms. It started out being called therapeutic cloning by its proponents. When that didn't work to get people to support it, then they changed it to somatic cell nuclear transfer for stem cells. That didn't quite work either, so now they just call it embryonic stem cell research when it's actually human cloning.
So you prefer the cloning term in there?
Well, I think it allows people to know what we're talking about. And I think that since these are the transhumanist issues, the cloning issues are really crucial to the future morality of society, and you and I agree this upon the definition and the stakes that are at stake in this debate. It seems to me if we're going to allow people in a democratic society to participate in these discussions, we have to have a common lexicon so that people can understand precisely what it is we're speaking about, so that crucial distinctions can be made, so that we can have nuance. You know, a lot of times the very progressive side says that the supposedly conservative side isn't nuanced. Well, we try to be nuanced a lot of times, and I'm saying we, although I don't necessarily consider myself doctrinaire conservative, because as you know, I've written books with Ralph Nader. I get pegged that way. But it's very hard to be nuanced when the lexicon and the words and the phrases and the definitions keep changing to win a political debate. I think postmodernism has come to biology, and I frankly think that's a corruption of science.
Now, your backers and many of the supporters of the kind of work that you do have a consistent, or what they see at least as a consistent ethic of life that causes them to want to oppose assisted suicide, euthanasia at one end of life, and fetal personhood at the other. Is that one of your principal motivations? I mean, you have a number of different complaints with this technology in your book, but have you adopted now the notion that human life needs to be protected from conception till the heart stops beating?
No, but I have adopted the idea that human life must not ever be considered an object, but must always be considered a subject. That is, when we turn human life, the question, and you and I agree on the question before the country, does human life have intrinsic value simply and merely because it is human? I assert that it must if we're going to have universal human equality. You assert in Citizen Cyborg that is an archaic way of looking at things, and that what should matter is consciousness, meaning that there might be some animals that would have greater value than some humans. So that is, you and I happen to agree on what the bottom line of the debate is about. And what I started out in fighting euthanasia and assisted suicide, you accurately pointed out in your review of my book, that I got into these issues because a friend of mine, who, by the way, was not terminally ill, committed suicide under the influence of Hemlock Society literature. And I saw what was being promoted, and I saw this as a really rank abandonment of people who are suffering, people who are depressed, like my friend was. And it was almost like whisperers were telling her, jump, 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 when those of us who knew her and cared about her were trying to keep her and holding interventions and trying to keep her in life. And that led me on a unexpected course to advocating, I guess, for human exceptionalism. So that turned out to be what my work is about, although I didn't know it when I began it.
Well, that's your activism on behalf of the euthanasia and the opponents of assisted suicide. Does that lead you to, for instance, oppose the law in Oregon, which allows people to get a prescription for a lethal dose of medication?
Yeah, I've worked very hard against that law and keeping that law from spreading for the last 10 years. I think it would be interesting for your listeners to know that the opponents of euthanasia and assisted suicide are not just religious pro-lifers or Catholics. Some of the most powerful voices against legalizing assisted suicide and euthanasia are disability rights activists who are pro-choice almost universally, are certainly secular in their approach, and are very much on the left side of the political road. And so what we've been able to do, and I've been a part of this, I kind of serve as a bridge between religious conservatives, Catholics, and others on what might be called the right, and disability rights advocates, advocates for the poor, medical professional, and so forth on the left, because, you know, I can be judged on both sides of those camps depending on the issue, I suppose. And so I've tried to be a conduit to help people who see the world through different views work together on some of these issues. We've been very successful in stopping the spread of assisted suicide beyond Oregon. There have been initiatives that have failed since 1994. There's been legislation that has failed many times since that time. And just yesterday, I was in Sacramento testifying against a proposal to legalize assisted suicide here in California.
Well, the disability rights argument is a slightly different one. They see the world as profoundly profoundly ableist, and
yeah,
that anything that encourages people with disabilities, and they see many of these terminal or slowly lethal conditions to be forms of disability,
right,
they think that this is a way to encourage disabled people to kill themselves.
Well, they see it as a dishonoring of the lives of disabled people. So that, just as an example, the new movie Million Dollar Baby. If somebody doesn't want to hear how that movie ends, they should tune out for a moment. But that movie ends with the assisted suicide of a woman because she's quadriplegic. And that is now being celebrated. It'll probably win Oscars. Well, from the disability rights perspective, and I agree with this, you know, you see this again and again, this constant statement and assertion that life with disability isn't worth living. Whether it's somebody with Lou Gehrig's disease who may be becoming progressively disabled, or whether it's somebody, as in this fictional person, who becomes quadriplegic, in television shows, in movies, in advocacy for what's called, quote, rational suicide. Again and again and again, we are told that while somebody who may want to kill themselves because their business has failed will receive suicide prevention, if you're a quadriplegic or if you've got a serious illness or if you have cancer, we'll give you suicide facilitation. And I see that, as do the disability rights activists, as discrimination, because the message is insidious, even if it's not intended.
Of course, your message in return is that we're going to take away the rights of people who are lethally ill or who have these disabilities because we don't think that they're smart enough or in tune enough with their own feelings to make those decisions in a rational way.
Well, they don't have the right to have the state or have other people participate in their self-destruction.
Because you don't want them to have those rights. In Oregon, they've been given those rights, and they have to be determined to be judged. They have to be determined to be sane and by two physicians and not terminally depressed.
Well, no, actually, they just have to be determined to be capable in Oregon, which means that they can communicate their decision. But what the society's primary job is to protect the lives of all its citizens, not some of its citizens, all of its citizens. If you suddenly became suicidal, Jim, so that it, beyond a reasonable doubt it, you were deemed a threat to your own life, the society has the right to step in and try to prevent that self-destruction. What assisted suicide is saying is that that bottom line foundational role of government no longer applies, that our ideology of self-determination should rule, and therefore rather than suicide prevention and suicide treatment to prevent suicide, that at least in some cases we should say, well, of course, autonomy rules and here are your drugs. And that turns out to be abandonment in my view, because there are studies have shown that people may who are, for example, terminally ill today may be saying, look, I wish it were over, I want to end it all. And a month later, if they're still alive, they're very happy to be alive. But we send the message that, well, that could never happen. And we say, well, of course, your life isn't dignified. Your life isn't worth living. You are a burden. So, yes, of course you should have your drugs. And that, I think, is a terribly insidious message. I don't think it's necessarily the intended message, but it is one that people receive.
I'm speaking with Wesley J. Smith. He's the author of Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. He's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and one of my sparring partners on many occasions. And we are on Change Surfer Radio today. I'm Dr. J. So you're critical, and many of the people in the Christian bioethics milieu are critical of the spread of individualism. Would you say that this is also...
Well, that's a bit of an unfair overreach, but go ahead.
Well, it seems like it's one of the consistent critiques that goes through...
Radical individualism, I would say. I mean, people, you know, I'm not part of the religious conservative movement, but I certainly support individualism, but we have no absolutes in this country. Every situation has certain checks and balances. And there is a dynamic tension between, you know, I want to do what I want to do, and what is proper and appropriate for society. And those are the kinds of struggles I think that the issues you and I disagree on are all about. For example, you support genetic engineering of progeny. I certainly oppose it, at least after you move away from therapeutic. You then say, well, how do you decide what's therapeutic? Isn't increasing intelligence therapeutic? And I would say, no, it isn't, and we go on. But it's the same debate.
Well, that's another part of the perspective that I think that you've adopted now. You've bought into the notion that there is some clear and obvious distinction between the natural and the artificial, and that's precisely what I'm all about challenging, that the entire world that we live in is a human creation.
Yeah, but if I take a look at your writing, which I have, and I quote it in Consumer's Guide, as you know, and if I look at some of the other things you've advocated, you seem to be, Jay, about completely tearing down all, first off, all what would be considered natural norms. You're against norms. You're against almost all inhibitions in terms of what freedom to engage in any kind of research, freedom to modify human life. Not only your own human life, but those of your children. You know, you want world government. I mean, let's face it, you're a very radical guy.
I adopt that proudly, yes.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, maybe it's my age. I used to be considered somewhat radical, and now I guess I'm somewhat conservative. But I think that there has to be not only the foot on the gas pedal, but you also need to have a foot on the brake. Because if you go too fast and you can become reckless and careen out of control, which I think your advocacy would have us do. On the other hand, if you don't have the foot on the gas, you end up stuck.
Well, one of the things I was a little puzzled by when you reviewed my book was that you didn't address at all the central message of the book, which is that, in fact, we do need controls. And that the central message of the book is that we need two specific government interventions in order to make sure that these technologies improve our lives. We need government intervention to make sure that they're safe, and we need government intervention to make sure that they're equitably distributed. You didn't touch on that at all.
Well, I did touch on the equitably distributed part, because I said that your idea is that we'll have a world government which would then use its resources to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to engage in genetic engineering and transhumanizing equally. And I said that's a ludicrous notion, considering the divisions within the world today, and the fact that so many of us don't even have basic health care. In terms of safety,
Let me ask you a question about that. Right now we have a global debate about access to antiretroviral drugs, drugs which are incredibly expensive. And I argue in the book that equitably distributed means, well, by the way, also within nation states, and so it doesn't necessarily require, in the first instance, world government. But we do have this global debate about antiretrovirals. Do you think that we should not have a global campaign to make sure that people in Africa have access to antiretroviral medicine, which is certainly not a natural intervention? I mean, many people would argue that they should just die.
Well, I think the people would argue that they should just die are social Darwinists. And frankly, I think transhumanism could have a real more than a touch.
Wait a minute. What I'm arguing is that when and if we have drugs which radically extend lifespan or which increase intelligence, that they should be as available in the developing world as in the first world, and that we need some kind of global institution to make sure that that happens. You're opposed to that?
Well, first, I'm opposed to the kinds of interventions, for example, to increase intelligence. The very definitions that what you are claiming is you can decide what human attributes are better than other human attributes. That is the key premise that leads to a pernicious eugenics, even though, as you will note in my book review of your book, I know you don't intend it that way. But it leads to oppression, because you are saying that by definition certain qualities in humans are more desirable and better and superior than other qualities in humans.
Okay, we have a federal policy right now that says that mothers should be encouraged to take folic acid supplementation during their prenatal course, because we know that it reduces the incidence of neural tube defects and spina bifida. Mm-hmm. Is that some kind of genocide against people with spina bifida? Is that a eugenic policy on our part?
No, I don't think it is, because you're trying to promote normal health.
Aha, there it is again, normal. You're trying to promote normal.
But when you say that the person with spina bifida has less of a value of life, which is...
Who says that? Who's saying that?
People say it all the time. People with spina bifida, for example, are going to be aborted because they have spina bifida.
So they shouldn't be allowed to abort?
Let me finish. Peter Singer, who is one of your favorite philosophers, would say it would be perfectly acceptable if a baby is born with spina bifida and it interferes with the interests and the happiness of the family to kill that child. And I'm not talking about abortion. I'm talking about infanticide.
Are you opposed to women having the right to abort handicapped infants and fetuses?
I don't think it should necessarily be legally prevented, but I find the whole drive to do that very disturbing. Because right now what we're trying to do, I mean, we say we believe in diversity, yet there's certain categories of humans we're trying to wipe off the face of the earth. Let's take a look at people with Down syndrome. If a woman gets tested prenatally and finds that she is carrying a Down's baby, the pressure on her, because I've talked to people who've actually born Down's children, and of course I hope you know people with Down's, I certainly do, the pressure is on them to abort. Now, when people with who are carrying Down say, I don't want to abort, I mean, it's almost as if they're doing something that is wrong. The rejection by doctors and the attitudes people have. I once gave a speech, Jay, to a medical school, and I talked against personhood theory, and I described how I believe that if you say that what matters isn't being a human, it's being a person, that leads to discrimination and that leads to inequality. And one of the students came up to me and said, you know, I'm learning how to do genetic counseling. And what am I supposed to do when a woman presents with a Down's child? And I said, well, one of the things you could do, in addition to describing the situation, why don't you bring in a family that has a Down's child so that the prospective parents can look and decide for themselves not only the part that people push, that is, you know, you're going to have a child with mental retardation, the child may have health difficulties and so forth, but some of the very special joys that families who have Down's babies experience.
I don't think that parents should relish the disabilities of their children because they bring special joys to the family. Let me ask you this. Do you think that we should act with moral censure towards a parent who takes a 2x4 and whacks their kid in the head and reduces their IQ by 30 points? Because if you think we should in that case, then I think morally the equation is, what is the moral decision of a parent who has not yet brought a life into the world who decides, I don't care whether this kid has 30 fewer IQ points or not. I think the moral obligation of all parents is to make sure that their kids have as many abilities and opportunities as possible in the world. Everyone accepts that, except apparently for the people who want to reject reproductive choice.
No, I believe, first off, you've just described the what goes wrong with transhumanism because it is inherently eugenic. And if you think they have that moral choice, eventually they'll be coerced by the state to force to do it. What I think the parents' obligation should be, and we're talking ideally here, is you universally, you accept unconditionally the child that comes to you, and you love that child, and you provide for that child the best way possible. I once cared for a developmentally disabled man. It was my ex-wife's brother, and he was not born that way, but he had German measles when he was 3, and like Helen Keller, he ended up with encephalitis. He didn't go
Wesley, let me
explain something here.
No, but your heart-wrenching stories about people with disabilities are fine, but we're not talking about that. We can love everyone with a disability and still hate the disability, right? It's a difference between loving individuals who are already here and having a social policy that says, you know what, in the next generation, if it's possible, we would like to see as little Down syndrome as possible. We would like to see as little quadriplegia as possible. Those are perfectly legitimate and, in fact, responsible policies. And anybody who tells me that the government should be totally neutral about the incidence of paralysis or mental retardation in the next generation, that's an insane social policy.
Well, I disagree with you because you're saying the government should take steps to require there be fewer of those incidents.
Well, let me ask you one last question because I thought it was quite striking in your book. You have found yourself now in political alliances with all kinds of right-wing elements, and yet in your book you attack bioethics for having gotten into bed with biocapitalism, which I find is quite bizarre and quite strange.
Well, it's
and
the Naderite
is it,
in me.
Is it really? Yeah, no, it's the Naderite in you, and it's kind of over the top Naderism because is it really your opinion that bioethicists in general have some kind of financial incentive from biocapitalism to tailor their opinions to be more favorable towards biomedicine?
I think that is a trend that is happening to an increasing degree, and it isn't just me who's worrying about it. Daniel Callahan has written about that issue.
Because people disagreed with him, and so he accused them of being
fine.
In the bed with cap.
It's a discussion. I do believe, and I cite the works of some bioethicists, and I cite the warnings of some of the pioneers in the movement, that is beginning to happen. When you end up with bioethicists on the board or being on the payroll of places like Geron or Advanced Cell Technology, who are basically there to give the ethical stamp of approval for experiments, and with the realization that if they don't come down on the right direction, they may not be on that board much longer, there's a problem. Bioethics is becoming...
You know where else where we see that problem?
Is
President Bush's political litmus test.
Not all bioethicists, but there are certainly those who are selling their services.
And President Bush is also, interestingly, using the same process of political litmus testing. All of the scientists and ethicists who get to be appointed to federal bioethics advisory bodies, like the President's Council, which, you know, you've worked closely with. So I think it's all around, isn't it?
Well, you know, you can make the council, you get the, first off, I think the President's Council was much more diverse than most of such commissions. In fact, it was, for example, on cloning, it divided 10 to 7. If you'd wanted to stack the deck in favor of a ban on cloning, Leon Cass could very well have done it. But he didn't.
Leon
Cass can defend himself, but I think he's getting a bum rap. But these commissions and councils, as a rule, I think have limited value if all they are is there to rubber stamp the policy of the government who appointed them. Bill Clinton's appointing of NBAC, the National Bioethics Advisory Commission, was clearly pretty much along the lines of a certain way of thinking. I think it was the predominant view in bioethics, which I oppose, which happens to support the idea of personhood theory and believes that the idea of human exceptionalism is speciesist against animals, which I think is ludicrous, and I think it's misanthropic.
So you think the entire profession of bioethics should just be excluded from the debate? Because you know that when Leon Cass went to the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities, he was, you know, roundly condemned when he went to speak there.
I don't think that bioethicists should be excluded from the debate, but I don't think that their voices should be given any more power over these issues than anybody else's, because who the hell do they represent, Jay? Are they representing the bioethical consensus? Are they representing the, if they're in a hospital ethics committee, are they representing the hospital? Are they representing their own opinions? There's, you know, a barber has to be licensed. Bioethicists don't have to be licensed. There's no, are you supposed to, is there only one way to think ethically? I mean, this is kind of odd to even call it a profession.
Well, I think that there is a legitimate question there, and I'm not arguing that bioethicists should have total control over these issues. But, you know, it's very odd that in all the different federal advisory commissions that the president has suddenly decided that people who have traditionally been considered to have expertise in these fields should be excluded so that the people with political views that are more palatable can be put into these things. I mean, Charles Krauthammer? Why is Charles Krauthammer on the president's council for bioethics?
I'm not on the president's council, and I'm not their defender, but I think Krauthammer was probably put on because of his disability, and he's bringing in a disability rights perspective.
Oh, not the fact that he's one of the leading neoconservative philosophers in the
country. I don't
think
that hurt his chances of being on the council.
Probably not.
But you had other people, like the sainted Burnback. I forgot her name. I'm sorry, really quick.
Susan Brownback.
The woman who lost her job.
Yeah.
You know, she was brought onto the council, and there are others who are there still who don't follow the supposed neocon.
And she was kicked off the council.
No, she is not on the council for reasons that go beyond her views. But I don't have that's my understanding. But I don't have. I'm not going to get into that. And Dr. May, who I have met and think is a very brilliant fellow, retired. There hasn't been this purging of the council.
And both of them were liberals, and both of them were replaced by conservatives when they
left
the council. That's right. Well, at any rate...
You didn't see any conservatives on Bill Clinton's bioethics commission.
Well, Bill Clinton's bioethics commission actually represented the bioethics community, which,
well,
you know...
That's right, because bioethics is no longer a discourse. It's an ideology and a social movement, which was the point I made in Culture of Death that the bioethicists get so mad at me for pointing out.
Yeah, but the culture, the politics that bioethics represents is liberal democratic politics, not liberal with a big L and not liberal and not democratic with a big L, but the notion that liberal democracy requires some kind of common secular set of values. And the culture that you have bought into and the values that you are bringing to the table are now clearly and almost explicitly religious, except that you continue to assert that yours aren't religious.
I don't make a single religious argument. And what you're saying is the only secular values that can actually exist are those that are liberal from the political perspective. And there are many reasons to have secular values. For example, universal human equality is a secular value, in my view. And that's what I'm supporting.
And when in Christian, the history of... okay. That'll be another show.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for coming on today, Wesley. Always a pleasure to talk
to
you.
Jay, it is always a pleasure to talk to you, and love to meet you sometime.
Great. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my change surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.